it feels like the walls are tumbling down. It doesn't mean that we're clearly over the moat, so to speak. We've still got a lot of work to do, but it is just a very, very positive set of developments that are bringing more wind into the sails of this industry for sure in the US.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto is a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Crypto Brief podcast from AFCAT. I'm Jason Ward, one of your co-hosts, and I'm here with Max Waddington and David Shapiro, and a special guest from Fidelity's government relations team, Stefan Patain. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Ethereum turning 10 and then shift our attention over to what has been a pretty monumental period in Washington, D.C. around evolving regulatory and legislative landscape that will influence the digital asset industry. And I have to say, personally, having been working in this area for about 10 years, I wasn't sure this day would ever happen in this type of environment be realized. So really looking forward to engaging Stefan on that topic and learning more about the actual background, the progress, and the hopeful output from these engagements. But before we do that, Max, I just wanted to ask you about something you've been diving into. And Ethereum is turning 10. So can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that? And maybe David Shapiro will throw it over to you as well.
Yeah, Jason, I don't want to make you feel old, but your career has been around about as long as Ethereum has. And it's definitely an exciting kind of event going on. And naturally, there's been just a lot of comparisons between Ethereum and where like other companies and entities were, you know, on their 10th birthday. So on, I think July 30th was officially when Ethereum turned 10. And I pulled up a quick comparison just because I thought it was interesting. But the average age of the Mag 7, the Magnificent 7, is about 33 and a half years old. So that kind of puts things into perspective about like just how long these companies or applications take to really change how society works, right? So while I do personally think that everything that's happened in the past 10 years has been really transformative, with starting with the DAO hack and the merge, right? There's been a lot going on, but I would argue that the next decade or even after that will be even more transformative to Ethereum. And especially given the big changes occurring on the regulatory front, which is kind of why we're here today.
And David Shapiro, any thoughts on Ethereum turning 10 other than, you know, the fact that it's been a pretty important stepping stone, I'll say, part of the evolutionary path of the industry?
Yeah, it's been really amazing to watch it over these past 10 years. And I think to a big extent, they still have sort of the world computer vision in mind. I think they still are kind of true to that vision. And yesterday, a prominent Ethereum researcher, Justin Drake, sort of released his vision for the next 10 years. And I'm just very excited to see where it goes and if they can deliver on the vision.
Yeah, so it's funny. I was fortunate enough to be visiting Dublin during Blockchain Ireland Week, and Justin Drake came in and gave a remote talk, but Vitalik Buterin was there too. And just being able to sit and listen to his perception on how things evolved and where he'd like to see things go, I think it's a really interesting environment for Ethereum to be operating in. You know, we've had Ethereum shift from proof of work to proof of stake. Decentralized finance really blossomed as a result of Ethereum. We have other chains that have come along, like Solana, that want to be an Ethereum killer, so to speak. But through it all, it seemed to have had a lot of success in evolving itself, and the developer community there is pretty strong. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of what happens there. And quite frankly, you know, it's an interesting way to sort of pivot and welcome in Stefan. So Stefan, as I mentioned, is part of our government relations team. And, you know, we're going to talk about a few things today. We'll talk a little bit about the Genius Act, a little bit about the market infrastructure bills and reference some recent output from the president's working group on digital assets and touch a bit on the SEC. But I bring it up because, frankly, you know, you would say that Tether was the first stable coin trading on the Bitcoin blockchain. But, you know, Ethereum has been pretty responsible for the, I would say, the rapid growth of stable coins and the DeFi summer from a few years back. But Stefan, as we dive into these things, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what it is that you're doing here at Fidelity, and how that work with the government relations team is really helping to shape our view of the industry?
Sure. Thanks, Jason. And happy to be on. Happy Friday, everybody. So I work on our government relations and public policy team and focus pretty much exclusively on crypto and digital asset issues. The easiest way to think about that is folks in DC are really interested in understanding what's happening in the ecosystem and how Fidelity views the space. And then folks who work for Fidelity are very interested to understand how regulators and policymakers are looking at the ecosystem develop and what type of policies they're trying to put in place. So we find ourselves in the middle there, facilitating conversations back and forth with both members of the aisles, with various regulators, various policymakers on an education basis, and then also for us to understand kind of the direction policies going and help shape that where it makes sense. I think the really exciting thing here is the digital asset ecosystem has been looking for some legislation to cross the finish line for some time. 2 weeks ago now, we saw the Genius Bill, which focuses exclusively on stable coins, get signed into law by President Trump. And it's wild if you think about just the sheer number of stable coin draft bills we've seen. I think it goes as far back as Senator Toomey introducing his version of a stablecoin bill, and then policymakers coming in and tweaking it and having other renditions in both the House and the Senate side. And so Genius passed the House 308 to 122 opposed, and in the Senate 68 to 30, which is pretty remarkable when you think about the bipartisan support shown there. And you think about politics today, sometimes we're very quick to think everything is a partisan issue. And I think this is one of the areas where we really saw a lot of engagement on both the Republican and the Democrat side. It's also the first piece of financial legislation to come out of Senate banking since, I think, 2018 or 2019. So it really takes time for this stuff to build momentum and to get signed. And happy to dig into that and some of like the specific clauses if you don't have any questions on the background piece.
I'm just floored at that stat that you just shared since 2018. I mean, you know, people have been born and are heading into second grade since the last time something came out of this. That just shows the fact this is actually a really monumental piece of legislation. And I think it's really important. And I'd like to ask too, you know, for stable coins, again, people for the most part are familiar with them if they're listening to this podcast, but there are different types of stable coins. And if my recollection is correct, in this case, the Genius Act is supporting stable coins that are backed at least 100% by US dollar denominated assets. So it could be cash, could be treasuries, could be repurchase agreements, I'm assuming, cash equivalents. But are there rules that would differ at the federal level versus the state level? Because I know that's something that we hear a lot about in terms of different applications of digital asset space.
Yeah, so at a very high level, it just addresses fiat-backed payment stablecoins. So you're exactly correct with the reserves that you're allowed to have. And the big piece here is it provides optionality on who can issue a stablecoin. So subsidiaries of insured depository institutions with approval from their federal regulators can issue a stablecoin. Non-bank entities, uninsured national banks, or federal branches of foreign banks can receive approval from the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. We've seen them in the past be pretty forward-leaning with the industry, but recently they've been a little more quiet until this past year. So they can now issue or allow entities to issue stablecoins at the federal level. At the same time, you still have an option if you want to be a state qualified payment stablecoin issuer. You can issue under a state regime as well. The state regime, though, has a $10 billion cap for market capitalization before you would have to convert over to the federal side. And if you think about like why this is so important today, if you're a stablecoin issuer in the U.S., you're working with 50 states. That's a ton of different regulators to coordinate with different requirements. Now you have the option to still pursue the state side, or you can have a federal charter or federal approval from a regulator and get coverage across all 50 states. And there's consistency in the requirements around the actual stablecoin itself. And then the other big piece too, there's a pretty substantial section on AML. So issuers are classified as financial institutions, and this is important for its relationship to the Bank Secrecy Act. So all these stablecoin issuers now have the same AML reporting and transaction monitoring requirements as other financial institutions that fall under the BSA. So it's very comprehensive in trying to get everybody under the same umbrella. From a consumer protection standpoint, issuers have to have clear disclosures. There's prohibitions on deceptive practices. There's requirements around public audits or publications of reserve composition. So it's trying to bring all these pieces together and have one uniform, comprehensive strategy that anybody who wants to issue a stablecoin can fall under, and consumers know what they're getting.
So if stablecoin issuers are beholden to like KYC, AML, does that mean that users of USDC are going to have to go through some type of KYC process to transact with the asset?
So you should think about it at like the issuance level and when you're interacting with an intermediary, right? So if you go to an exchange, that exchange is going to run KYC on you in the US. USDC or other stable coins are also monitoring the transactions from like a sanction requirement. And say they see activity coming out of the U.S. going to a sanctioned address, they have to comply with lawful orders that may require them to seize or freeze or burn or prevent transfers. I think if you look at how a lot of the current stablecoins in market today operate, it's more of a freeze capability. So if they get a lawful order, they can go in and say, okay, we're going to freeze this account and this wallet can no longer move move USDC out of it or whatever stablecoin they might be talking about.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, what I take from your description here is that there's an intention to standardize how these payment stablecoins can be issued and can be leveraged and make them, frankly, more accessible, maybe bring down some of the barriers to adoption that institutions or individuals or companies have experienced. And I sort of think about it almost like the standardization of the railroad gauges for tracks and making it so that there's more interoperability potential. So even if you know you have stablecoin A and stablecoin B, you question, will they be similar? The answer is probably because of this type of standardization. They may have different underlying structures of the collateral pool, but the expectation is that they will perform like for like. So I think it's really important. I think it also sort of underpins what we talked a little bit before the show is that it seems that the environment today is one where across the legislative and regulatory landscape, there's a clear and common mission. And it seems that that mission has led to a lot of collaboration and focus over the past 6+ months in bringing forward clarity. And frankly, having been in this, Max, you were kind enough earlier to suggest that my career is about as long as Ethereum. I dare say my career is a little bit longer than that, unfortunately. But, you know, we've been seeking regulatory clarity for years, and it sounds like we are advancing towards that goal.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. One kind of final point on the stablecoin piece specifically that I think is really important. There's always been a question on how do you classify a stablecoin? Is it what is it, a security? Is it a commodity? Is it something else? And this bill carves out its own new asset and definition of a payment stablecoin. So it's in its own little ecosystem now, and people know exactly what that is and how to interact with it. And to your point, clarity, I think stablecoins are often viewed as like the low-hanging fruit for policymakers to like wrap their head around and understand how they work as a kind of like intro into the space. This was definitely the warm up before we start really digging into the market structure discussion. And that's where stuff gets, I think, much more complicated. But you've seen the historic bipartisanship work back and forth. We're seeing that now with market structure. And I think the reason there's been so much momentum or movement on the market structure side as well is because people kind of had the warm-up rounds with Genius and with other payment stablecoin bills for the last few years.
That is great. So momentum is building. And Stefan, one of the things that I imagine must be very challenging in your world is the fact that you are dealing with two houses of Congress. And we talk about competing projects or priorities. How are things unfolding around that market structure? Do we see differences between the House and Senate versions?
So the same day Genius passed the House also passed Clarity, which is their version of a market structure draft. Now, Clarity was introduced in the House, whereas Genius was introduced in the Senate and then came over to the House. So now the Clarity bill has to go over to the Senate. So the Senate is in the process of interpreting what's in Clarity, but at the same time, the Senate Banking Committee has released the first half of their version and principles of market structure. And we're going to see this kind of meshing of the two bills, most likely. But both chambers have different processes. So in the Senate, a bill can only progress or be introduced in one committee at a time. So right now it's at the Senate Banking Committee, and then it has to go to the Senate Ag Committee because there's going to be commodity aspects of market structure. So it's going to probably be a longer process, but they've started that, and they've been really engaging with the industry and trying to solicit feedback on the Clarity structure as well as what they're proposing on the Senate Banking side.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, and there's some pretty clear differences between the two drafts. So I think probably the one area that everybody's focusing on and everybody wants to know the answer to is token classification. Clarity has this concept of a digital commodity. It's regulated exclusively by the CFTC, and it applies only to tokens as part of this mature blockchain system. In the past, we've seen other kind of renditions of what they're using as a mature blockchain system. But then the Senate introduces this idea of a ancillary asset, and an ancillary asset allows issuers to self-certify with the SEC that a token is not a security. And then the SEC has 60 days to object whether or not they agree with that. And the whole like concept behind this ancillary asset is that a digital token that's offered in connection with a investment contract, but it in itself may not be a security. And the idea here is to distinguish the token from the investment contract that it may be associated with. And it's a clarification aimed at separating the digital asset from the way it was initially sold. So people are trying to solve or answer similar questions. They're going about it in two different ways. I would say at a very high level, Clarity is much more prescriptive right now. And the Senate draft is giving more deference to the SEC when it comes to rulemaking.
So if you look at like the version of Clarity that the House passed, they have these definitions of like what a decentralized blockchain is and what a mature blockchain is. And it has to do with if one party has control over the chain. And it seems that a lot of the language or definitions could be left open to interpretation. So could we end up in a place where one SEC interprets the law in such a way that they don't consider a number of assets to be commodities, but then a new SEC comes in with a new administration and they say, well, we interpret these definitions in the law differently, and so we would say that these assets are not commodities, that they're securities. Is that a possible future?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And it's why we see a difference in the level of how specific the drafts get. So Congress's job isn't to legislate down to the nitty-gritty rule. It's to tell the regulators, these are areas of jurisdiction. These are where we want to see you write rules around. We're seeing what I would argue is a greater level of detail in some of these versions than others, because folks want to make sure what you're describing doesn't potentially happen in the future. And that's why there's such a level of specificity in one versus the other, where you see so many pieces going back and forth. And it's interesting too, because we're going to shift over to the SEC, I think, at some point. There's a fundamental question here of, does Congress need to pass legislation for the SEC to be able to make rules in this space? And if you look at the current administration's positioning, specifically with Chairman Atkins, he's been very clear that the SEC has all of the authority or the tools in their toolbox to issue new rules through the notice and comment period, which is public. That's how the system's designed, to start building frameworks for the industry without needing substantial legislation.
Right. Yeah, I guess one thing that's sort of different about blockchain assets is that you can assign a huge variety of different properties to them. Whereas before, you know, the type of assets you see issued are sort of bound by stricter limitations. So I'm curious to see if we will be able to come up with a set of rules that can encompass, you know, all of just the tons of permutations that can come on blockchain assets. And one thing that the SEC chairman announced yesterday was an innovation carve out, where he basically said, if the regulations in place don't fit for, you know, the innovation you're trying to engage in, we will have a carve out where we're just going to ask you to try to meet the spirit of the regulations in place. So maybe that's something we can talk about.
Definitely. And I think like this question, people have been trying to address in the past. That's why we've seen frameworks where they're talking about how an asset can morph and change over time based on its level of decentralization or control. Commissioner Peirce has been very forward-leaning in terms of providing principles on how you could build a regulatory sandbox for these projects to kind of test in, what type of safe harbors we would maybe need, and then how can we connect with foreign jurisdictions who have already done this in the past. So it's all been talked about for the last 5 years. And in the last 6 months, we've really started to see the SEC push out guidance and statements talking about how they're going to address these going forward.
I have to say, I'm personally excited about the possibility of there being more specific guidance and also flexibility. So I do recall the comments from the SEC, from Bill Hinman, about the Ethereum being sufficiently decentralized and trying to figure out what does that really mean. But I also have been around for long enough to have a broken record type of complaint somewhere out there about the fact that the lack of clarity was driving innovation offshore. And we were seeing flight of both talent and capital to different places. And you know, what I was reading, and Stefan, I'm interested in your take on this too, is that the president's working group had instructed the SEC to basically help clarify and write rules and create that innovative space that David was just talking about, to create the environment which will bring back potentially some of those entities that chose to move offshore. But either way, create an environment that is more conducive to innovation in the U.S. and experimentation. And it seems that Chair Atkins has instructed the policy team members of the SEC to go out and actually get very active in this space about clarifying and writing these rules. So, you know, I think in some ways this direction will help clear up a lot of the ambiguity we've seen as an industry. But I'm also very, very curious to see, you know, how might we define, you know, what is a digital asset security versus digital asset commodity or non-security? And frankly, how will we actually see tokenization evolve as a business model? So any thoughts you have on the president's working group or even the direction that Chair Atkins has given the staff?
Sure, of course. So if folks haven't already looked at it, everybody should go download the presidential working group report that just came out on Wednesday. You can really carve it into four different pieces. It talks about what type of regulatory frameworks we need, agency collaboration, a focus on innovation, and global competitiveness. At the end of the day, all this is doing is aligning priorities across DC, which is great to see because we started with an executive order saying we're going to align priorities. For the last 6 months, we've seen some of that in action, and this is codifying it. Chairman Atkins gave a speech that I think people are going to remember for a while in this area, at least, where he said, and I'm quoting this, plain and simple, security intermediaries should be able to offer a broad range of products or services under one roof with a single license. Nothing in the federal security laws prohibits SEC-registered trading venues from listing non-securities on their platforms today, and I've directed the commission staff to develop further guidance and proposals, ultimately to make this super app vision a reality. So he's directly speaking to one of the biggest questions that have existed, which is, can broker-dealers interact with digital assets, whether they're securities or non-securities? And his positioning is pretty clear. Even before he came out and said this, the SEC has been extremely busy over the last 6 months. We saw them pull back SAB 122. We saw them release a statement on stablecoins. They withdrew previous guidance on broker-dealer custody and then issued new guidance and a statement around how broker-dealers could potentially think about custodying digital assets. And we also saw a statement on staking and how entities should think about staking and staking as a service. And then just this week, they gave approval for in-kind redemptions on the ETPs. These are all questions that the industry has been poking at and trying to get answers to for years. They did this all through a process of soliciting feedback, engaging with the industry, and then hosting all these roundtables. And this was really before Chair Atkins got to the seat. And then yesterday, he really outlined his priorities for the next 6 months to his full term. So I'm pretty excited to see where this goes.
Yeah, it is amazing. Like, candidly, as you say this, and I'm not even joking, gives me a little bit of goosebumps, gives me a little bit of fire. Like, we have been working on this type of aspiration for years. And, you know, you talk about the changes to the custody rule, you know, no longer going to require the commingling of customer assets with bank assets, which basically increase the risk for consumers in the event of a bankruptcy. You talk about the fact that even, I think it was 2 weeks ago or in the past 2 weeks, you saw a joint statement issued from the OCC, the Fed, and the FDIC clarifying that banks can, in fact, hold digital assets in custody for users. And then we've seen a slew of announcements lately about companies and banks working together to bring more accessibility. So it feels like the walls are tumbling down. It doesn't mean that we're clearly over the moat, so to speak. We've still got a lot of work to do, but it is just a very, very positive set of developments that are bringing more wind into the sails of this industry for sure in the U.S.
Completely agree, and I think just the level of transparency that the agency has right now in terms of asking for feedback, putting out feedback, hosting roundtables as soon as they think there's an issue that they want or that folks would like them to opine on. They've been very quick to acknowledge those pieces, and I think that's one of the reasons we've seen so much of this new guidance come out, is because it's really been a two-way street with folks trying to engage with the agency and the agency listening and understanding kind of what they need to focus their priorities on.
Yeah, I mean, Max, David, guys, I mean, think about this. We've spent years just drinking from the fire hose of technological development, and now let's make to shift gears and find out what's actually happening on the policy and regulatory front. It's good, but it's just so much to take in. Really, really appreciate stuff, and you're sharing all this insight. Guys, we're going to be short on time in a few, but any other questions for Stefan?
I'm excited for the return of airdrops to people in the U.S. and things like that. That was one thing that Commissioner Atkins spoke on specifically was, you know, we want people to engage with American investors. You know, we want American investors to be eligible to receive things like airdrops or participate in ICOs. And yeah, it'll be exciting if those return to the U.S.
I'll leave you guys with some fun homework. One thing I've been noticing is if the the executive branch, White House, is making an announcement or talking about something in relation to digital assets, go look at all the agencies, because there's probably an agency releasing a interpretive letter, a new statement, or some new piece of guidance that happened with all the EOs. It happened right after the presidential working group. So check out all the agencies anytime the White House is saying something or trying to coordinate. It's a good spot to watch.
Excellent. Well, this has been fantastic. Stefan, thank you again for joining us. Max, David, always great to talk with you guys, and we'll catch you guys soon. Thank you.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.